You're listening to Catalyst for Change, and my name is Jessica Huckabee, your host. I started this podcast to learn what makes people resilient after challenging events and how they've used those series of events as a catalyst for change in their life. You'll hear stories of resiliency and strength, so get ready, sit back, and be prepared to be inspired. Today, my guest is Dr. Artika Tyner. She's a passionate educator, an author, a sought-after speaker, and an advocate for justice. At the University of St. Thomas School of Law, Dr. Tyner serves as the founding director of the Center on Race, Leadership, and Social Justice. She's committed to training students to serve as social engineers who create new inroads to justice and freedom. Dr. Tyner leads by example by organizing policy campaigns, fostering restorative justice practices, developing social entrepreneurship initiatives, and promoting assets-based community development. She serves as a global citizen by supporting education, entrepreneurship, and women's leadership initiatives in Africa. Thank you, Dr. Tyner, for coming on my podcast, Catalyst for Change. And I really want to know more about what events in your early life really influenced you to be an advocate for social justice?
The earliest event in my personal life that inspired me is being a daughter of Rondo. Rondo is a historically African-American community located in the heart of our capital city in St. Paul, Minnesota. And Rondo and our story is a story that unfortunately far too many communities across the United States have experienced. There are at least about 1,000 cases of racial removal that are documented. So when you think about racial removal, I'm talking about a legal and also a policy construct that brought in the federal highway and interstate system into communities. And unfortunately, oftentimes, those communities happen to be African-American communities. Those community hubs and those anchors that were destroyed, like Rondo, with the highway coming right through the center. Community members lost intergenerational wealth by losing their homes. They lost their businesses. So for me, I would say that early experience of not loss, but an early experience of hope and determination to preserve our culture, our history, our businesses, and our background really compelled me to become a civil rights attorney. Wonderful. I understood that piece of how do you use your voice to make a difference.
Wonderful. So tell me what your involvement was in that and how you used your voice in that early circumstance that you're speaking about. Can you elaborate more on that?
So in the early circumstances and early experience in my life, it's just being aware of that piece that one of our Rondo community organizers always says, God, voice, God, power. Yeah. So being aware that I could use my voice and make a difference. So I've been using my voice since I was a young girl. My mother jokes that maybe I was born talking because I would ask those questions of why? Why is there homelessness? Why is there poverty? Why is someone hungry tonight? And then I would compel my mother, so she was my first audience, with the next question, how can we make a difference? And those questions of why and how never left me. Those are the questions that still inspire me today in my work in the classroom, outside of the classroom, and being involved in leading change.
So you started with your voice. You started out as a young child seeing what was wrong or what you can change for the better in your community and in your way that you could as a child. And you got your mother to change and help change things around her as well. So she was your first audience member. That's really interesting. Very nice.
Our mothers, they make a difference. And, you know, it also is a good example of oftentimes we think about leadership, about who is, you know, senior to someone else by age, by experience or position or title. My mother taught me, and I hadn't thought about this before in the early lessons, that is relational and it evolves. That simultaneously, we have to be both those leaders and followers to accomplish our shared goals, to make our shared humanity and common destiny come alive. We can't be lost in those labels.
I agree with you. So many people get caught up in the leader or the follower, and they really want to be one or the other. But we can share those titles, and whoever brings that expertise can take the lead on different things. I really like that perspective. Can you tell me more about the nonprofit work that you're involved in?
Yes, I founded the nonprofit Planting People, Growing Justice Leadership Institute in 2017 to address an issue that had bothered me for years, that far too many of my clients learn how to read while in prison. What a miscarriage of justice. First, to not fully cultivate their academic, their educational experience, but secondly, to know then that if someone had the possibility to read and had the possibility of the tools of literacy, that they would be able to advocate for themselves in the legal system. So I teach my students, we see a problem, we create a solution. So when I saw this problem, I decided to take action. So our nonprofit is a direct response. We focus on promoting literacy and diversity in books. Promoting literacy because far too many children are unable to read. 1 in 4 American children are not reading at grade level by 4th grade. If you're not able to read, it increases your likelihood of dropping out by 4 times. But here's the connection to the criminal justice system. It increases your likelihood to be arrested in your lifetime 3.5 times. So here's our chance to make a difference. So not only were we promoting literacy, to date, we donated over 7,000 books in the community, but we also wanted to make sure that we are addressing the racial disparities in education by promoting diversity in books, to make sure that young people could see the books that are mirrors that reflect them, because you're more likely to see a book on the cover with a black bear or a black dog than a book featuring as a protagonist a black girl or a black boy. So we rolled up our sleeves, created Planting People Growing Justice, and we continue to march forward in promoting our mantra that leaders are readers.
Oh, I love that idea of making sure that everybody's represented in the books that children see, whether it be at school, in their libraries, in their communities. What a great idea to do that. And what results have you seen from the work that you've done in your nonprofit?
The results have been remarkable. We're changing a cultural landscape that reading is for everyone, that to have not just those mirrors, our books are also windows. Windows for other children from different backgrounds to see in the cultural experience of their peers, of their other friends at the playground, at the schoolhouse. So really our books are an opportunity, not just for that representation piece, but the windows to understand and appreciate culture and really honor our shared humanity and common destiny. And we've been able to take this mission around the world.
And that leads me to my next question. Tell me more about what you're doing internationally.
Internationally, it's been an honor and a privilege to work with our king, the king of the Apamo kingdom, King Akoto III. Adenaho has been dedicated to better outcomes for everyone, to ensure that the children have access to a quality education that creates those next steps, going to college and building those careers and a lifetime of service in the community. So in that way, I ensure that I serve the king. It's his 10th anniversary, so I have to do a shout out and thank him for his leadership and service. But at the same time, ensuring that we provide the learning tools, the resources for the children. So we also help to donate books, share educational resources, and host a youth leadership forum in one of the districts within his kingdom in Senshi Ferry.
Oh, wonderful. So you're working internationally with a king in the continent of Africa and helping deliver those books around the world, both within the United States in your own community and communities around the United States, as well as internationally. I love how that circles around to that community. So now for my next question, I was wondering if you can tell me what interested you in going into law?
Well, for me, of course, law is a language of power. So I was determined to become more well-versed in that language to fight for my community. For instance, I told you a bit about Rondo, but there were some real challenges. My family was fortunate. Our family home was on the other side of the highway. But what about those other families that with the laws of eminent domain, they lost their intergenerational wealth overnight? Of course, they weren't paid for values for their homes. Of course, those that lost their business didn't get the support that they needed to rebuild or relocate. So becoming a lawyer was natural to me because I thought of once again that chance. We are the ones we've been waiting for, that civil rights song, letting your light shine, all those pieces. So I decided to march for justice. And the best way that I could do that was by becoming an attorney.
Oh, wonderful. So what are you doing in your law practice at this time?
Presently, I am a law professor. So I teach civil rights law. I'm committed to training and inspiring that next generation of lawyer leaders. I was inspired by, so here's a little homework for everyone. I was inspired by a very special attorney to become a law professor. And that would be the legendary Charles Hamilton Houston, who reminds us that a lawyer is either a social engineer or a parasite on society. But I would modify it a little bit and say a leader is either a social engineer or a parasite on society. So using the same mechanisms of changing civil rights laws and policies to make equity and equal justice under the law come alive, I teach in the classroom and helping to continue to build and bring forth the legacy of Charles Hamilton Houston.
Wonderful. And I'm going to go ahead and look him up after we're done on this call. So thanks for that information. And I really like what you said about a lawyer being a social engineer at their best. And that's what you're doing. You're helping to shape a better society by training others to go forward with their law practice. So thank you for your service to our communities. And so your interest in law was piqued by your community and your upbringing. And so it really speaks to your heart and soul and the people that you love most. So I really like how you use that early childhood experience to further, you know, social justice in the world. So thank you for that as well. And so you've used your background and education for social justice and social change by being a professor of law. Are there any other projects that you're working on right now for social justice and social change besides your wonderful books and giving back to the community, your law professor work? What other things are you doing?
Okay, I'll tell you just a couple hot off the press. These are not even fully public yet, but these are the ones that I'm working on right now, right this moment. The first one is the Black Doll Project. And when I say doll, of course, I grew up with Barbie, and Barbie didn't look like me, the ones that I had. Same thing of those mirrors and windows of the experience. But here's the thing, go full circle to Charles Hamilton Houston. Although most folks do not know his name, we wouldn't be in public spaces, we wouldn't be engaging the way that we do without his legal advocacy. And just here, a little history. Charles Hamilton Houston laid what Dr. King talked about. He laid the highway. He took out the roadblocks and impasses to civil rights as we know it today, because he laid the foundation for the seminal case of Brown versus Board of Education. Although he didn't live to see it, notice what I'm going to say. His mentee, his student, was able to argue that case. We know him today as Justice Thurgood Marshall. So that's a quick history lesson. Okay. But a big piece of that case, the first time the social sciences were used in this way, was the Black Doll Project, or TESS, that was created by Drs. Kenneth and Mamie Clark. They used that doll test to demonstrate the impact, the psychological impact of racial discrimination. The reality of it is they traveled throughout the South, throughout the nation, to ask young people a simple question, to ask young Black children a simple question. Which doll, comparing a Black and a white doll, was more intelligent? They then asked the question of which one was beautiful and which one was bad, which one reminded them of themselves. Unfortunately, even with the recent replication of the research and the studies, the answers are still the same. And it breaks my heart to even talk about it, that the reality of it is Black children still think that the Black doll, their own heritage and identity, is bad, that the white doll is smart and beautiful and wishing and aspiring to be the white doll.
Yeah, that's very powerful. Now, this study was done a while ago, but has there been some change the way people look at themselves and self-esteem in the Black children based on having Black dolls, dolls that represent them, or brown dolls that represent people with brown skin? Have there been any changes in the way people feel about themselves?
Well, that's why we're starting the project, to do the research and actually increase and make Black and brown dolls more readily accessible. But as far as the research and replicating that test from the 1950s, unfortunately, and studies within this past decade, the results have been exactly the same.
Oh, yeah, we have a long way to go, it sounds like. And this is one step in the right direction, is creating the Black Doll Project. Wonderful. Now, what other things can you tell us about, like the sneak peeks into what you're doing currently and in the future for social justice?
One sneak peek is, I already talked about Ghana and shared my love for our king. The other piece, of course, is most of my books I've written in Ghana. And it's just a time and a space, and there's something tranquil, there's something peaceful. It's you're locked in the loving arms of your ancestors, and you're with your people, and the food is wonderful, and the beaches are beautiful. So you can't help but to be inspired. Yeah. So in that essence, I wanted to bring that to the people of the African diaspora, but once again, to bring it to everyone, that experience. So here's my invitation. Please join me in Ghana. But back to the sneak peek. The sneak peek is that we've launched a new creative hub for artists to come together, a retreat center that has the beauty of Ghana. It was in partnership with my friend and colleague, Lisa Peck, who is the founder and principal of Lilu Interiors. So she designed our new community writing center and artists retreat center to look like and feel like Ghana. So we are working now for the fall to open the space to allow our artists in residency and allow artists to come together. And it's named Aya's Place, A-Y-A. And Aya, as an Adinkra symbol, helps to remind us of the power of resiliency and determination. And if we don't need it now, I can't think of a better time that we need it. And it was created in response to the dual pandemic that we have right here in the Twin Cities. Of course, the racial disparities with COVID-19. And after the murder of Mr. George Floyd, looking to create a space where people could come together, reimagine, and create racial justice and racial healing in tangible ways. So Aya's Place has been a source of inspiration. And over the past year has brought me joy as we come close to the 1 year anniversary of the killing of Mr. Floyd.
That's a wonderful tribute to create Aya's Place for artists to come together and create something. Now, are there any other things that you're working on as far as policy reforms or things you can tell us about policy and how you're working to affect change in that area?
For policy reform, of course, I'm focusing on policing. Yes. And looking at some of the challenges. I mean, we've seen policies change across the nation. We need to finish our work at the national level and also state by state to ensure that we have the appropriate level of accountability, of transparency, public trust, and to really create. Oftentimes we think of it, it's the police versus the community or community versus the police, but to create the type of public safety vision and reimagine public safety that focuses on the sanctity of life and focuses on all of us being interwoven together as one community. So that means that I'm working on the Philando Castile Omnibus Bill here in Minnesota, where I reside, to ensure that one, we give honor to as well the legacy of Mr. Castile. His mother has asked us to get involved to make sure that this racial equity bill helps to bring the resources that we need to build a stronger, more united Minnesota. We know that we still hear the cries of Mr. Floyd crying out for his mother. So having a deep understanding that we need to finish the work related to the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act to ensure that we're looking at accountability around safety, around resources, around training, around community engagement. So my work around policy reform has been at least a couple decades strong. But right now, those are the issues that I'm working on, policing and community reinvestment.
Wonderful. No, that sounds like such a good cause to be working on and so relevant for the times that we're in, is to have people, the community and policing, to come together for public safety. That's such a great thing that you're doing right now. Now, are there any other things that you can tell us about what you want to be doing in the future as far as your policy work, your book writing, and your retreat center, Aya's Place?
The future for me is to continue to grow. I look forward to, for instance, for Aya's Place, we have it here, but I look forward to also having Aya's Place in Ghana. I look forward to that way we can encourage, I know President Otto encouraged folks to come home, to get connected for the year of return, but now we're beyond the return, meaning that we will continue to come back and connect to our cultural roots of learning and growing together and connecting to the African diaspora and the continent. I would say for the policy work, my agenda is to mobilize and teach more people, because the reality of it is most people think that their connection to policy ends at the ballot box for the large national and federal election. But our work has also focused on ensuring people are participating in the census, that they stand up and be counted. I wrote a children's book about that. So now I'm working on a new children's book about why it's important that if we have voice, we have power, and we must not only vote, but remain civically engaged 365, 24/7. So my next campaign is to make sure that we're working on the policy side. Notice I'm not saying on partisanship. I'm indifferent to that. I'm talking about ensuring that everyday people understand that they can use their voice, not just at the ballot box, but they can use their voice to influence policies. They can use their voice to influence the annual budgets that are set forth by the governor, by Congress, by local organizations. I really want people to get mobilized, to create change block by block, family by family. Here's our time.
Yes, that's so important. And really calling out that we all have a voice and we all have a duty to affect policy change and make our world better. One person, you know, can do many things to help that go in the right direction. Wonderfully put, Dr. Tyner. Now, is there anything else that you think we may have not gotten to and you want to make sure to mention?
My goal is to continue the work each and every day. So I encourage everyone that's listening in to get involved. Get involved in Planting People, Growing Justice. You can host a book drive in your community to help bring diverse books to your little free libraries, to your actual schools. There are too many ways for us to get involved and collaborate. And I just want everyone to remember these words. Now is your time to really ask that critical question of what is in your hands to make a difference in the world. And I'm convinced if we all ask that question, and we unveil the limitless potential, the transformative power in our hands, well, we can make a radical difference. We can build the type of world that we want our children's children to live in. We can do that today.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on my show. I really appreciated talking to you. And I know our listeners really did as well.
Thank you for the opportunity to share.
You've been listening to Catalyst for Change, and my name is Jessica Huckabee, your host. Join us next week for another story of resiliency. And please subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts, and feel free to leave me a comment or email me at catalystforchange20@gmail.com, or on Facebook, we have a page at Catalyst for Change Resiliency.